Horsemic scan initiated. I'm picking up a podcast arriving. Wait. Designation: Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, We All About All Souls Podcast. I'm joined by Tanya Gates.
Hey everybody.
Red Powell and Adam Camilleri.
What up? G'day.
Welcome to the show. I am fresh off of the ATC, the 8-player team tournament event that just happened in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's basically in my backyard. It takes me, I can get to Chattanooga sometimes quicker than I can get to the center of Atlanta.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's crazy. As a Canadian, I find like the short lengths between your like cities and towns amazing, and then I also find the concept of like your big city traffic also amazing.
Yeah, I was gonna say, as someone who has lived and been around Atlanta, it was not as, that's totally makes sense.
Yeah, but it was nice to be able to kind of just cruise up there, take a leisurely trip, you know, leaving my front door whenever I wanted to get to the event hall, you know, whenever I needed to. That was, it's always nice when you can have one of those events kind of in your backyard. And getting there and playing in the 8-player team event, they actually did the 5-person team tournament at the same time, which I wasn't sure how that was going to go, but it went really well. It's 2 independent tournaments happened in the same place. Hundreds of people playing Warhammer.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, right? Because I think when you're playing teams events, usually what you see is a team event and a singles event running together, where, you know, if you, you know, you say you don't have a team nearby, or you just want to travel to play in a singles event, you have that option. Or if you are a local or you have a set team, you can rock out and go to the team event. But to have 2 team events of different sizes running at the same time is really unusual and unique. And the fact that it had like hundreds of people in both is pretty amazing.
Well, if anyone could pull it off, it's the crew that does that. Shane and Chris are the primary organizers, but they've got a great staff of judges and volunteers and folks that help them run that. And like, as if anybody could do it, it could be them. So I went into it with somewhat skeptical, but also optimistic. And it turns out this looks like they stuck it, you know, on all levels, and was happy to be a part of it. And also happy to play with the team over the course of the weekend. I was playing Death Guard, which I mentioned before, and I mentioned my list, you know, kind of like a brick list. And if I would alter the list, I think a little bit at this point in time, you know, with the hindsight of the event behind me. But at the same time, I did what the list was supposed to do. So it's almost like inevitable, like whatever the gun list is, in this case, you know, Blood Angels or Grey Knights or whatever, I'm going to find myself in conflict with that list.
And by gun list, you don't mean gun line list. You mean like good list.
Like, yeah, like
top of the metagame list.
That's going to shoot for the 20s.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the max points you can score. They're going to try to max points in a game differential of that. They're going to try to get hundreds off you, try to put up big wins for their teams. And they will, you know, we kind of position my list is like the sweet meat, like one that they think they're going to be able to do that against. And fortunately, as you know, as maybe you know what I'm saying here, I'm very familiar with lists like Blood Angels. Mm. And so I know what those lists are capable of doing and what they're going to want to do. And I can play in such a way that denies them those points, puts them in positions they don't want to be in. I would prefer to have maybe won one or two of those games. But the fact that I was able to kind of blunt what their other teams expected of that contributed to several round wins for the team. And, you know, that's what the list was there for. So
well, exactly right.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah.
In any team event, you want there's kind of 2 interesting trains of thought. There is, if you're playing in a small teams event, like say 4, 5, even sometimes even 6 players, you can kind of just get away with playing like the 4 to 6 literal best armies in the game and their best singles lists. Because at some point, there's no way they all get trapped and pinned and flipped. But when you start going to 8 players, you really need diversity of role and delineation of what these lists are taking to do. And we come back to Adam's favorite term, fit for purpose. So you need a purpose for the list, and it needs to be designed to do a role for the team. So it sounds like you were the merely grindy list. You wanted to go into the middle of the board and grind on the middle objectives and be a bit of a stop sign to opponents trying to get big scores.
Yeah.
Which, Adam, you missed this whole conversation last week. We talked about
fit
to purpose and stop signs and everything.
Oh, no, bless you. No, bless you all.
We didn't say any of that.
I brought up, we talked about this. Jebaited me. And here I thought you guys were cool.
Oh!
I was like, where was I? That's what I was thinking. I was like, what?
You were tired. You were tired.
Yeah. The pre-shows are great. I'll just tell you that. But you are, Adam, you're exactly right. It's like the idea was to create this almost like situation that gave them like a bit of a false insecurity and then lock them down. And I got questioned a lot. It's like, you know, even by the players that I was playing, it's like, why on earth do you not have the fights first mechanic in your list? I was like, dude, I'm the one that launched all the charges. I don't need that. Yep. Like when you're always charging, it doesn't matter. But that goes back to having like the fundamentals of the game kind of, you know, locked away in the brain of when, how to move around. And so, you know, those types of tactics really helped me kind of control the momentum of the game. I wasn't scoring the points that I probably would have preferred to score if I had it, you know, if I could draw it up the exact way that I wanted to, but I was at least basically controlling the momentum and tempo of the game. And I felt like I was contributing to the team because of, you know, denying some points to the opponent. So and you know, it got to play, the rounds were 4 hours each. My games did not go anywhere near that.
I love the 4 hour.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yes. But occasionally you see somebody like going over time and you like look at them and like, what on earth are you doing?
How?
Yeah. How? But we have this like this adage that 40K players will take all the time you give them. You know, it doesn't matter. Right.
I mean, it's proven to be true. I've played at some world level events where they give you team events, and they give you like sometimes half an hour, 45 minutes for pairings, and then and setup, and then 4 hours from like turn one to the end of the game. And I remember the head coach at one point walked up to me and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Down there, Adam," because his name's Neil, he's a good mate of mine. "There's two guys that are just finishing turn two, and there's 3 minutes left in the round. I'm about to tell them to both go back to their home countries because they shouldn't be here."
On the plane.
And I'm like, absolutely right, mate. That's 2 hours each for two turns each. It's an hour a turn. What are you having a picnic between each? Are you going and like, are you drawing a beautiful sketch of the European landscape or some kind of watercolor?
I consider myself like as casual as you can pretty much get. And even I can get my games done in like, at the very most, like 2 hours, 45.
Hmm. It's been a great difference from, I guess, 8th and 9th edition to 10th edition that I think the games have gotten tidier and somewhat cleaner. But still, people will take every second that you give them. And 100% the adage is confirmed at this point.
It's like, what's the state of matter that just expands to fill the volume? Is it a gas?
Yeah, we are all gas.
Yeah.
I mean, we are podcasters, so that makes sense.
But in speaking of the team, you know, I mentioned this before, just phenomenal group of folks, and had a great time hanging out over the weekend and doing things like going to get dinner afterwards. We actually made reservations for the whole team like a week before the event at places, so we'd make sure we knew we had a place to go. You know, with that many people around in a small area, sometimes the restaurants can fill up. So that's a little tip for you. Anybody doing this next year, make your reservations. And had some nice eats, had some nice hanging out, like every night, you know, hanging out together, which was cool. There was a fire alarm that went off in the hotel. Not us. Wow. We didn't cause that. But we were dead tired. And some of us started to peel off and crash, and the fire alarm happened. You're like, you know what? Let's keep this party going for at least another hour.
It was the buildup of gases.
It was the buildup of gases. But like, it, seriously, shout out to the folks for the team that came and filled in for some of my team. The normal crew, the crew that we had originally planned to go with, they had some things that came up, so they couldn't make it. Some other folks jumped in and filled those slots and just performed phenomenally. We ended up taking 10th in the event.
Top 10.
We were, I think, 4th or 5th going into the last round, and then the last round did not go very well for us. But that's 40K. Right. It's completely okay. Had some great games. Mentioned I played against Blood Angels twice. And I also got to mention this, is that Lamartis and the Sanguiner still come on 25 millimeter bases.
Yes. In addition to the Nightbringer is on a 40. We have come so far, and yet we have so far to come.
Yeah, and that did not affect our game at all. But I had like a conversation with one of the Blood Angels players, like, you know, I think, you know, I think, you know, might run into some trouble with some folks if they say something about the bases. And turns out they just come with them, like always come with them. Like mine are on 32s. Like, well, what did I do?
You modeled for disadvantage. How dare you?
I know, right? But whatever. You know, public service announcement. Sanguine and Lamartis still come on 25 mils. Mm. And then apparently Nightbringer's in a 40. But played two Blood Angels and a Grey Knight player. Grey Knight players seem to also do really good against Death Guard, by the way, just in case anyone was curious.
Yeah, the keep away game is strong. And then Death Guard don't always love the army with the 2-up save. Like, the whole army has a 2-up save. That can get pretty awkward. 2-up with Armor Contempt. There's a lot of AP1, AP2 from Death Guard that can get negated.
One of their special abilities, I think it's on the Paladin Squad, is they ignore modifiers. So, you know, like, you can take a Contagion that gives a -1 to hit, and they ignore that. And even the -1 to save, you're still putting them sometimes just at a, you know, a 3+. So yeah,
it doesn't hurt them as much as it hurts just about every other army.
Yeah, and they've got all these really powerful movement abilities. They let them be all over the board, which makes it really difficult for your stuff that moves 4 inches to keep up with. There really wasn't as much of a liability as it sounds like, but when you're deep striking a lot, whatever, but it could, when you're playing against Grey Knights that even further amplify that, it felt, you know, real punishing. I did play against Thousand Suns, and that was a great game. These were all great games. These were all actually very fun and engaging games. They were more tactical than interactive, probably. That's about the best way to describe it. And you could tell that that maybe my opponents were expecting me just to run at them.
Mm.
And that was not happening. Nor should it have happened. You know, it's like, that would have been like surefire defeat. Well, you know, gone down in a blaze and would have given up all the points that I was supposed to be holding on to.
That's another hallmark of teams events. Like, unless you are the World Eaters player, that's, or the Blood Angels player, or the player that can't play in any other way, usually in team events, people take the path of no risk. Because whilst you've told your team, like, I should be good here, usually you say that with a grimace, like, you're like, I should be good, and a thumbs up. And then you're like, I really don't want to be wrong, so I won't take big risks. And you usually find a little bit more safe play, more like, I think that the term you use is perfect, more tactical rather than engaging. Like, yeah, it's got to be worth it.
Yeah, we should go again, because every time, Adam, I just tell people, I'm just going to come at you. It's not going to, that's it.
Well, I did say there was exceptions.
That's right.
I'm conjuring a scene from Firefly right here, where she says people who are loud, you know, get dead, and then Mal jumps in the back yelling and screaming, "I'm right here, come get me," and all this stuff. She says there are other schools of thought.
Good reference.
I'm proud of that. I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, that was a good one.
The Thousand Suns game, I felt like, oh great, I'm going to be able to get a little aggressive. I paid for that. There's a lot of shots coming out of the Thousand Suns army. A lot of quality shots. And, that game ended in a draw, which was pretty cool. With the last, the draw coming from being able to charge an objective and out OC it there at the very end to put us into it like a deadlock draw, which is fun. Nice having coming on down to that. But I basically just gave away, like, just gift wrapped and kissed goodbye unit of Plague Marines as I tried to get to. I'm like, man, somebody I can actually run into. Whew, wrong. It wasn't a gotcha moment either. Like, he told me everything the army did, including where the special abilities and how the characters were layered in and that kind of stuff. But he just basically shot me to pieces with this chain flamer thing on one of his characters. It's brutal. Can't remember the name of it.
We affectionately, in my, because we have a very accomplished Thousand Suns player in my Warhammer team, we affectionately call that the super gun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's super.
It's super brutal. Yeah.
Super something.
I'm tough. I got all these abilities. Because one thing, when you're playing a somewhat reactive game or less interactive game, you accumulate a bunch of command points. And yep. I mentioned that I was always the one getting the charge off. Well, the one time I didn't get the charge off, it was the Death Company charging into a unit of Typhus's Destroyal Terminators. You know, so, and I in that time, that game, I'd also taken the Contagion that made him -1 weapon skill, ballistic skill. So they're -1 to hit, -1 weapon skill, ballistic skill. And I popped Disgustingly Resilient because I've got a billion command points. It's like this, the only reason this didn't happen because I didn't want it to happen. You know, like, that you charge me because I let you. feel the wrath of Typhus, which was fun. That part was fun. Being able to use all the tricks of the Death Guard was kind of fun, and I can see how they, you know, are fun to play if you can get over that. I think so. The change I would make is, like, I was planning on doing that maneuverability and aggressive in the middle of the table with a bunch of Terminators, and I think I would prefer to have gone with like triple the amount of Plague Marines. Like, if I could just rolled in there with 60 Plague Marines, probably would have. I could have been a little bit more cavalier and probably accomplished the same goal.
It's a hell of a list. I think we've chatted in previous episodes about, you know, when the game changed in what's, you know, into the Pariah Nexus pack, the incentivizing of battle line.
Yeah.
I think I came out and said that I think Plague Marines are like a top three battle line unit in the game. And you can just lean right into that because they're a unit that can do everything. They can shoot medium well. They fight medium well. They got jank. They got mortal wounds. They can really do it all depending on what you're willing to attach to them and how you're willing to wield them. That could be a topic for another day. Like, what are the top five battle line units in the game? Because there are some really wild ones. I got bad touched by some tower breaches recently. And I was like, that's a top three, too. That's a top five, at least.
Well, it's things like even like secret missions, you know, and raising banners, you know, those points are add up, and having units that can interact with them more, you know, is even an option.
Yeah.
Probably is going to convert into more game wins.
Well, man, secret missions are such a foil to the predictability of team matchups. I actually played at a team event on the weekend as well. I played a Dark Angels Gladius list. And in our last round where we... I think we ended up coming fourth or fifth. We just needed to get a win in the last round, and we'd secure a podium spot, and we got a draw. And that was pretty much because a player who was losing pretty hard secret missioned on the bottom of got it on the bottom of turn five and flipped it from a loss into a draw for them, and secret missioned us off the podium. I mean, you can't say anything bad to the player. I played it freaking perfectly. Really well done to them, and I'm so happy secret missions are a relevant part of the game because I ain't never gambited.
Yeah. they really are. And there's even like a member of my team, Carter. He designed his list to push people off the primary, to control basically the primary at every step of the way. And he was really questioning himself. He's like, because he got secret missioned, that he still won the game, but it gave that player enough points to turn what would have been a win for the team into a draw for the team. That's just the way it shook out in the order in which the games were scored. If I had scored more points, we would have done better that round also. So, you know,
I played a Tau retaliation cadre list in the second last round, and we had Tau in our lineup. And when we paired, my Tau player walked past us and he said, you know what he's going to do, right? He's not going to push much. He's going to play for a 10-10 draw, and then his commander is going to go back into reserve on turn five, 3-inch deep strike onto your home objective for 20 points on secret missions. And then because he told me that, I rushed 15 Deathwing Knights at that commander when he hit the table. I'm like, I'm not giving you the chance to do that, mate.
Yeah.
And it was huge. Because he was going to do it. He was going to do it and flip the game.
It's some excellent foresight, because you're exactly right.
Because people can build that. There are a couple of factions that could build that into their list. Magnus is a really good one for that as well, because he has to be your warlord. And then if T-Suns a lot of the time can be, you know, very high up on secondary, but maybe not doing as well on the primary. And then you just triple move Magnus onto your opponent's home objective. There ain't no unit of five scouts that's going to hold it over him after shooting in a fight phase. And there you go, 20 points.
Yeah, it is just that simple. The secret missions, especially in the team environment, you know, becoming familiar with them. And I think that you hit it on the head a little bit earlier, also saying that the gambits, you didn't say this specifically, but maybe this is what you're thinking about, is that the gambits gave us this impression that we're never going to do it. But now it's like a real viable thing.
It takes up real estate in the back of your head. If you're up on primary, you need to start like ticking over what your opponent's army is good at doing, or have they built any of these, you know, secret missions into their list. It's actually going to be really big to unpack for the next couple of months whilst this pack is active. When we like review lists and look over stuff, did they build a secret mission in?
And people are using them, and they are viable, and you will have some games flipped because of it. But, you know, really cool that it is a thing, and people can feel like they're in the game. And probably if I, you know, talking about list changes or whatever, had foreseen, like already foresaw that I was going to be in real grindy situations where I'm eating a loss. Like, but what if, you know, could have taken a little bit of tuning just to be able to have one or two secret missions open to me in case it was close. might be beneficial. So see how that goes. Saw a great Black Templar list over the weekend that had 60 Crusaders.
Oh, what a lag. Characters.
Yeah, was wrecking folks. I think the actual top battle point finisher was a guard player.
It was indeed. I actually just had a quick look at that. I'm actually putting together the part two of one of our other shows as we speak. And yeah, I was quite impressed to see guard get the pole position.
And just wrecking folks. I mean, it was a great event. Ran smooth. Of course, the camaraderie of the teams is always something that I really appreciate. Not in the hotel, like the convention center is attached to a Marriott. In the Marriott, there was some other cool things happening. There was like a tattoo convention. There was some other things happening. It was a cool mix of folks and good atmosphere and the hotel. And anyway, just really had a great time. So thanks for letting me riff about it.
Yeah, it sounds like a blast. I regret that I was driving across America during that time. Next time.
So Adam, how did your team event shake out like across the board?
Oh, it was phenomenal. I had a great time. I ended up going 4 wins, no losses, 1 draw. And I was really happy to be playing a little bit of Dark Angels again. I've been playing Guard. My team pretty much said, we'd love it if you played Marines, Adam, instead of Guard. And so I went with it. It was another option. I possibly would have been playing Chaos Knights as well, but our Custodes player wasn't quite happy. He didn't feel like he could get quite good enough on them in the time that he had, so he decided to take the Chaos Knights. I jumped on the Marines. Man, Marines are good. Marines are very good, especially Dark Angels. There's a lot of good stuff in Dark Angels at the moment. I was joking with my opponents as I, kind of walked 15 Deathwing Knights at people that, man, this really feels like somewhere between Custodes and Necrons. Like, they're like, these are like Custodes, Custodian Wardens and Canoptic Wraiths had a baby. And because Deathwing Knights are absolutely brutal now. And then, of course, I was just playing a regular Gladius. I still had the unit of 6 Eradicators with the Apothecary Biologist for the Firestorm. For the Fire Discipline, because I was really trying to hunt Necrons with this army. I was really trying to pressure Necrons and Knights because I knew there'd be a lot of both. And I didn't play against any of those. I played against Astromil Tyrum. Then I played against some other stuff. I played against Tau. I played against Tau twice, which was interesting because I got a draw versus one and then a big win against another. And it just shows like one of them was on Search and Destroy and I was able to get the big win on that one because I was able to start close, put the pressure on them. And the other one was in Hammer and Anvil and I just couldn't close the distance enough that I felt like it was worth throwing units out to see if I made long charges. So we just played a very passive game.
And was it like a true Hammer and Anvil or was it one of the new staggered deployment type?
The staggered deployment one. Okay. I can't remember what the name is. So I call it wonky Hammer and Anvil until my brain catches up with the meta.
Yeah, yeah.
The mission pack. But yeah, really fun event. I really had a really, really, really good time. And my team, I played with a bunch of aspirants to the national team competition in Australia. So I got to pair up with some of the new bloods. And man, really impressive guys. They took it very seriously, put in a lot of effort. Because usually at an event like this, I would just rock up and one of the other guys would pair me and I would just play whatever. These guys, we were having phone calls, we were doing list chats, we were doing pairing matrices. Yeah, really cool stuff.
That's fun. How'd y'all end up doing overall?
So I think we ended up coming fourth overall. There was 4 teams on the same win path as us. So there was one true undefeated team, and then there was 4 teams after that that were all on 2 wins, a loss, and 2 draws, all of them. And so I had to go to count back. And it was pretty funny to see that there was one clearly like probably the best team there, and we all pretty much thought they were likely to win. But then straight under that, it was a absolutely vicious Shark Tank with pretty much all the next 4 teams beating a pretty much even strength. And it was awesome that pretty much all those 4 teams played against each other. And we all ended up with kind of drawing each other, being pretty much of equal strength. So I think that was a really cool narrative.
That seems to be how like these team events shake out, is that there are a lot of people that there is one team that is doing really well. I shouldn't say the only team doing really well, but it seems to be a team that hasn't taken any losses or draws. And then there's like four or five that are just won't need one more shot at it or to have a couple things go their way. And they'll catapult to the top.
Yeah. And in team events, it's not about like, it's not just about being a better player. There's so many more things that go into winning a team event. You gotta have players that I prepared don't need to be a great player in the game. You just need to be good on your list and in your role. You need to have good pairings. You need to have good data. You need to have knowledge of the table selection process and the tables that are going to be available. And then, you know, of course, the mission and how that influences table pick and how that influences the pairings matrix. And it all just has a big snowball effect. So you'll find that the team that ends up winning is not that they're like 100% or so much better than everybody else. They're probably just like maybe 5 or 10% better on a couple of those matrices, and that's enough to get an edge.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different things that factor into how well your team is going to do in any given round. I know we talked about this in the past, so anyone that remembers it, forgive me. But actually, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back about how talk about how these a round gets paired and tables get chosen and that kind of stuff. See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, we are back. Got the whole crew here still. And want to talk about the pairings. And not only the pairings, but also table picking. And in an 8-player event can get perilous. Like there's a lot of things to consider with the way that the pairings get shaken out. And a 5-person team, it's a little bit different than 8. I know we've talked somewhat extensively about 5s in the past. Happy to go. The first set of pairings, you know, on through like to the 4th are about the same. It's the last pairings in an 8-player that get seemingly a little different. But there's also the element of the table pick. And now, thanks to the Games Workshop US Open Series and events run by GW, there is several accepted terrain formats and layouts with positionings of their terrain pieces to create staging areas, firing lanes, and things like that. Y'all know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
And those are repeated, twice each on the terrain of the tables, the 8 tables. And you roll against your other team. Whoever wins the roll gets first table pick. So how that happens is you roll, get the higher roll that comes into play in a second. What first thing you do is you put out your first defender list. So you place a army down for them to hand you then 2 choices to pick from for that list to battle, and they do the same for you, vice versa on the other way. So they put down 1 list, then you give them 2 armies to choose from to fight. Ideally, what you do in that situation is you give them 2 hard choices. If you give them 1 list, or of the 2 lists, if one of them is guaranteed an easier matchup for them, they're going to take that. So I bet everyone's saying, well, of course, no duh. You know, if that's what you want to give them some choices, right? But having the right list composition in your stack of lists to put out there is part of the game, of figuring out what are the things that you anticipate other players are going to bring, you think they're going to be their first put out types of situation, and then what do you submit to them to choose from that gives them like a choose their poison situation instead of just the obvious pick. Once the pick has been chosen, whoever won the roll off gets to pick the table. So you've got yet one other area to get an advantage. Let's say you didn't get the best pick that you wanted because they gave you 2 hard choices. Now you get to pick the table that you want to battle on, which could then give you the things in your favor. Rinse and repeat till we get to like the 5th. I think it's the 5th pairing. Then you put out list, and the things that have never gone out to be chosen to either attacker or defenders then get automatically paired up in the 8th matchup. And then the table pick trickles on down through that, alternating between you and your opposing team, you and your opposing team, you and your opposing team, until all tables are picked. So there's a lot of failure points for yourself in that exchange.
Yeah. Well, the beautiful bit about its design is that most of those pairing structures have been designed around 8-player events. And they get a little bit, it's a little bit less brain intensive the smaller the team is, because you have less control. When you and your opponent, so you and the opposing team both have 8 players and you have an extreme amount of control, it's almost impossible for one team to get good matchups all the way down, to get 8 matchups that are positive in their direction. Like your opponent would have to literally be in a coma at the table, at the pairings table, for that to occur. At some point, you're going to have to make a compromise. You're going to have to put in, you're going to have to select a matchup that is unoptimal for yourself in the hopes of gaining benefits for the rest of the pairings. And sometimes this can be called, putting somebody under the bus. because your army, I mean, so I went to the World Team Championships representing Australia in 2019, and we didn't have a solution for the 6 to 9 Eldar flyers that were taken by most teams. And so every round, we had to decide who had the worst overall matchups into that team so that they weren't that big a waste when we threw them into the Eldari sacrifice. Flyers to try, because if they had like 4 or 5 bad matchups apart from those Eldari flyers, then using them against to just go under the bus versus the Eldari flyers saved them, so we get better matchups into the ones they weren't good into anyway. So if that was a hard way of explaining it. And so it was a really interesting thing to be like, well, we don't have a solution for this, so who's worse everywhere, they can go under the bus. So we dodge them getting trapped by somebody else who we can beat. And that's just the give and take, the tug of war of the pairings process. It's extremely nuanced. It's a lot to get your head around. And usually, like, people who are very good at pairings, like they're just very good, are also like people who are great at chess and great at other psychological based games, you know, poker and things like that. It's actually quite an interesting skill set. And when you find somebody who has that, hold on to them, keep them happy. you don't want them angry at you at the pairings table.
that's a great point. Pairings is a bit of a kind of a science in the way that you need to know what the capabilities of the list are, you know, what are the juicy special things that the army is trying to do, and then how to present them with those terrible choices. And then if that all else fails, make sure you get the good table pick. And I think assessing your opponent's list to find out that you don't have a great answer for something, and then exactly to what you said was find the least effective list in your army or your set of armies and figure out a way to try to get them matched up with their best. So, you know, worst case scenario, what was going to happen happens anyway. Slightly better scenarios, you take a little bit of that away from them with points, you know, anyway. So then you play the games. Typically, when you go to score the games, the games are scored on a differential, you know, based off of how your points are somehow tabulated based on the difference in which you won or lost by. Typically getting down to 20 points, somewhere between a 20-point split between you and your opponent. If you both did okay, both get 10 points, and then you have degrees of not okayness or amazingness on either side of the scale from there, which makes the numbers, you know, kind of easier to wrap your head around, I guess. Then you just do your best, which is what it's all about. And that's how team tournaments go.
I mean, there is an alternative to doing like all of this tactical thought, and you can just do random pairings too.
That's how you really throw, because some people show up with like Excel spreadsheets with matrices. Yeah. And stuff like that.
Yeah, my team, we just went in there and we just did random pairings. We threw these little tokens inside of a bag and just randomly pulled them out. And then we random rolled the tables. And it really messes with your opponents and their spreadsheets. That's for sure. Anyway, we came in second in all categories. We were very proud of ourselves. Very, very shocked because
amazing.
We just wanted to drink beer, but we ended up doing really well.
You cannot argue with success. Like, the proof is in the pudding.
There was a team at the event I was at who had a spinning wheel. They had literally had like a wheel of fortune with all their armies attached to the wheel, and they would spin the wheel, and that's who was going up as the attackers, defenders. And they were obviously the coolest and best team there because no one could compete with such style and panache.
I want to borrow that idea for next year.
Although it's hilarious. We played against a team. We spent a lot of time because they were one of the better teams, and we ended up getting a draw versus them. And we spent we got a little win. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out who they were going to use as their first defender. And then they shuffled their cards and just slapped one down. And we were like, oh, wow, crap. We just wasted all our lunchtime trying to figure out what you guys were going to do. And then they flipped it up. And it was the one that we thought they were going to do. And we were like, oh, no. We got to the same result anyway. It was a good time.
I like that. It's a look, that's part of the joy of these things. You are experiencing 40K with not only just yourself, but, you know, with potentially 16 other folks there hanging out. And people's approach to it, as long as it's in the right spirit, is, you know, it's cool to kind of witness and see how it all shakes out. But as we talk about team events, you know, being like some of the coolest ways to enjoy Warhammer 40K in a tournament setting, because you are not just winning and losing for yourself, you're winning and losing and sharing the joy or the burden, you know, with a group of folks, which is fun.
I feel like my team, we always go for like style points. So we're currently working on getting like team kit completely sort of figured out. We've got our jerseys, which are sick. I designed them myself. Nice. Yeah, I mocked it up for the guys, and then they're like, yeah, awesome. So then I sent the mock up to the printing company, and they're like, this is awesome, you should just do this. And I was like, okay. But anyway, now we have warm-up jackets as well, and I'm trying to convince I'm trying to convince the guys to get like gold lame booty shorts. I think I'm really close to getting them to say yes.
Look, it's a weekend, kick back, you know, whatever you're comfortable in.
That's right. You know, I don't get to play roller derby anymore, so if I could at least have this one thing, this one throwback to my roller derby days, it would be gold lame shorts. I just want to make this happen.
I want it also.
Oh, baby, I'll buy you a set if you promise to wear them.
I will. Yeah, you get me a set, I'll wear them.
Hell yeah. Okay.
It is decided. So looking forward to the next event. There are some other team events coming up in this year. And so if you are curious about getting involved with something like that, you don't know where to start, hit us up in chat or something. Happy to share some thoughts about maybe where the best team events are to hit up there. Also, if you don't have a team and you're looking to get on a team, a lot of teams find themselves in the same situation that mine did, needing someone to fill in. And so there are many, you know, groups out there that you can join, Discord channels, Facebook groups, and that kind of stuff. Where people would gladly want to pick up someone that plays a faction or are willing to travel to one of these events to be in a team. And it's pretty cool. Can't say enough good things about it. And especially about the ATC is it is ran by some phenomenal folks. And if as far as like tournament organizers and tournament runners go, always down to support them and talk about their events. And glad I got to actually play. A lot of my play time at events is taken up, you know, talking about events. Mm. Speaking of talking about events, the Games Workshop Tacoma event is happening this weekend. And you can tune into the Twitch channel and hear some people talking about 40K that cool. You might recognize. So please do. And that, I'm curious to see now that the Pariah Nexus like meta is starting to bloom, what we're going to see emerge, if anything different, as like top list.
Man, if only there was a podcast that I could listen to that might give me that information.
And just a squad of handsome individuals to run said podcast. Where would we get those? We'll find them.
Easy there.
There's the fantasy territory.
There is a show called the Warhammer Meta Chasers. Meta Chasers being slightly ironic because what we do is we look at the factions that are being played by everyone, not just top players, not just a group of players, but across the board, across the globe, all the major Warhammer events happening everywhere in the world. We are taking a look at their factions that people are choosing, and then we also look at what's winning. And so we look at the trends of what is kind of happening out there, what some of the top players are doing, what some of the, you know, the trends of people, how people are combating those known quantities. And then we do an after show. That's on the Patreon stuff, but I don't want to hype that too much. But we actually look at what's winning. And curious to see if we're going to see any shakeups this week.
Me too. We've had a really diverse, like shooting the lead a little bit on the kind of the part two for our other show. We had an extremely diverse bunch of top tens from the biggest events of last week. One of the ATC top tens was 10 unique factions. I believe the 5-player team event had 10 unique factions.
Wow.
In the top 10, which is just everything you want to see in the game. And then also one of the large singles events we had also had 10 unique top factions in it in addition. That was the TGX over in Canada, in Ontario. 10 unique factions in the top 10. That is just, that's like golden age of 40K kind of stuff.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to pitch that other show. But I also wanted to bring up the fact that with this amount of change that's happened in the game, you know, it's challenged a lot of list builds and conventions. And then when you've got that advent, also the inclusion of the secret missions, you know, there's what's going to be winning consistently out there. I don't know that there's one absolutely dominant thing yet. I mean, outside of Marines painted red, like to charge a lot, you know, but But they check off a lot of boxes, right? Like they are good at removing people from objectives and then being on those objectives. So with that, you know, things being challenged, you know, what is there going to be a dominant list? And you know, like I mentioned, that they can, this one list I was talking about is really good at just removing people from objectives and then being standing on those objectives. And that, I don't want to say something unique to them, but that certainly has some qualities. But now that people know that that is something that is either something to aspire to do or that is going to happen to them, and how do they prevent it from happening, you know, are people going to go back into the think tank and make something to counter that? And then what is that?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. In fact, funnily enough, some of the largest team events in the world are starting to put together pins. And what we mean by a pin, as in like two – like if somebody was to try and defend, and this is kind of linking things back to the team chat, and this is where you really identify where people are finding counters or hold lists for these big aggressive, you know, bomb style strategies like Blood Angels. So a lot of the time, Dark Angels is being used to counter merely aggressive lists like Blood Angels, and which is very interesting to me. And I think that's really exciting for future Adam and Paul interactions. But also, you know, things like that, people start looking for fights first. Like, it's an aggressive melee faction. People start looking for the same things we were doing when World Eaters is one of the best factions in the game. We want to stack things like fights first. We want to find things like fight on death for a cheap going rate, or with some assurances, like there are some 2CP automatic fight on deaths in the game. Or you want to have, you know, a 1CP that has a better than a 50% chance if you can find it. And if you can't, try and just have that as a psychological threat against your opponent. But these things, everything in the game right now is relatively evenly balanced. People out there are saying that Sisters and Blood Angels are probably the two best factions in the game. But usually when we talk about two best factions in the game, we talk about there being a bit of a cliff. Like, you remember at the start of 10th edition, there was Eldar and there was GSC, and then there was the, like, a massive cliff far, far away where the rest of the armies played.
Yeah.
That is not the case right now. There's only probably like between 10 and 20% power difference or dynamic difference between the top factions and the rest of the pack. And a lot of the rest of the pack is still using indexes. They haven't been fully fleshed out factions with codexes yet. So such a good state of the game right now. It's so exciting. And I will say that codexes, that, so armies that only have indexes, have less ability to go and look for that depth, look for that next rung of technology to bridge gaps and have better
interplay. That detachment they weren't considering before, you know, because they've only got the one.
Yeah, exactly right. You kind of got what you got, and you have to look for like things like characters or individual units that can give you a different look.
Yep, got it. Great point. So just, I like it that it is kind of like any given Sunday out there right now, is that a lot of armies can play into different armies. And, you know, that is largely, I shouldn't say largely, but certainly a contributor because of the missions, secret missions, and then the terrain, the kind of the accepted terrain formats out there. And if you're curious about what that terrain format is and you want to experiment with it in your home games, I highly suggest you check it out. I'll try to put a link in the show notes about where to see these terrain layouts, because it really does open up viability of so many lists, which then creates a better play experience for the folks that are not taking a certain style or one particular list.
Well, in addition, there's a lot of, so we know 10th edition is a very lethal game. We've got a lot more terrain on tables in order to compensate, and it's been a bit of a journey getting us to the stable and fantastic position we're in now. But you can just still take so much lethality in your list, but then you come into the issues of it just gets blown up. Case in point, there were some Tau lists that I've seen recently that are just so brimming with good gun. Like, they have triple Hammerhead, triple Sky Raid, triple Riptide, you know, some Piranhas and Ghost Keels, and all these just brilliantly good units. And then when they deploy them, I, as the opposition, get to kill three or four of them because they can't hide them. There's not enough real estate. Logistically, they don't, you know, cut the mustard. Whereas, you know, people sit there with, and, you know, by the power of math and rolling dice at home, you realize you can blow up your entire opponent's entire army in one turn, if you can see them, and if they don't get to blow yours up first. Yeah. And so there's a lot to think about there in the logistics of the game.
I'm loving it. Love the way the game's at right now. I really love everything that we have out so far. It makes me feel good about things that are going to be coming out. And I'm kind of like staring at hobby stuff. Like, what do I paint right now? I just did all those death cards. Just did some cards.
I literally just built three Inner Circle companions last night, and I wish I had 9 more, but man, they are sold out everywhere in Australia. Ooh. Yep.
There we go.
Wish I was coming to Tacoma. Could have raided the store.
Ha. I'm painting a second Dorn right now. It's part of the things I'm
nice.
Painting.
Nice. Yep. There's a good thing to be painting at the moment. Dorns are in a fantastic spot.
Yeah, you're talking about they came down points-wise a little bit.
Yeah, they came down points-wise to a very attractive price point. Essentially, a Lehman Russ chassis with kind of more gun than a Lehman Russ. Like, it's kind of the power of, say, probably a Lehman Russ Crusader and a Godhammer pattern Lehman Russ, the firepower put to, sorry, a Land Raider put together, and very buffable, very supportable. And all people, all guard players have so many points now because they're not taking 700 points of boring backfield artillery.
feels like it. But yeah, it's been a while since I've painted some Astra Militarum, so it's kind of cool to get back in there and paint some tanks because they are awesome.
I am not too concerned about chasing the meta, so I got a second Gorkonaut because I just think they're neat.
That's a good reason. Marge potato.
That's right. Yeah. And like, you know, I just figure I liked having a Gorkonaut and a Morkonaut, so like, why not just put another Gorkonaut on the table?
I mean, I'm not going to dignify orcs with having anything close to like tanks, but I am glad to hear that big metal things are getting painted and put on the table. So
when the Gorkonaut Morkonaut kid came out, because G-Dub had been giving us like snippets, like little glimpses at the kit for a while before it launched, if I remember correctly. And when it came out, I was a little bit like, I wanted it to be a little bit more dynamic than just kind of, here's a brick with arms. But then I realized it is so modifiable. Like, there is so many beautiful blank slate conversion things you can do to that miniature. That is, I now think it's exceptional. I really, that really came all the way around on it.
Most orc things you could just literally take, you know, sprues themselves and just attach to it and say, look, orcs.
Yeah, what you do is you pour glue all over every flat surface you do not want to have be a blank flat surface. You get a ice cream container of a relevant size or something big enough for your said orc piece. You pour, I don't know, half your bits box into it, and then you throw the model around, put the lid on, and shake it. And bada bing, bada boom, you've orcified your miniature. Thank you very much for coming to my TED Talk, everybody. I'll be back next week.
The whole thing fits.
I think that's a great place to end the show. So I think that's going to be our show this week.
You're welcome, everybody. hobby tips to make orc stuff.
We ended with a finishing move. Hit all aspects of the hobby.
Thank y'all so much for listening. Please do not forget to hit the thumbs up button. If you're listening to us again on YouTube, sorry we were not published on YouTube for a little while. Now we are republished on YouTube. And so if you're there, please leave some comments. Hit thumbs up. All that kind of stuff means a whole lot. If you're hearing this part of the show, go ahead and subscribe. You like the show. please do that. And other than that, we'll see y'all next week, everybody.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye, everybody.
Orspec scan is clear. I think they're gone. For now.